Good morning. I'd like to welcome you back to the fourth lecture in our series on an introduction to the regulation of financial institutions. This is Professor Howell Jackson, and today our topic for discussion is capital requirements. In particular, there are a number of topics I would like to discuss in today's class directly related to capital regulation in the United States. We will look at the Cushata case and the Winstar case from the Jackson and Simons casebook, and also discuss various capital exercises, problems 320 and 321. But before we turn to those issues, there are a few introductory comments I'd like to begin today's class with, the first of which deals with the activities restriction exercise we were discussing in the previous class, and then I would like to say a few introductory words on capital requirements. Let's begin with activities restrictions. As you will recall, at the end of the last lecture, we were discussing various strategies that a banking institution or depository institution, and in these lectures I'm using these terms interchangeably, even though depository institution is a broader category, we were discussing the two possible strategies, strategy A and strategy C, and in particular, special problems associated with higher risk investments associated with strategies C, and in particular, investments in travel agencies. What I asked the class to consider at the end of the last session was whether there were justifications other than risk regulation for restricting banks from investing in travel agencies or other commercial firms. And in particular, I invited you to consider whether there might be antitrust considerations, unfair business practice sorts of considerations, or other public goals that might argue for restrictions on investments in commercial lines. Now, I'm not sure how much members of the class thought about this question, but in the United States, this is an important and difficult question about the regulation of financial intermediaries, particularly the antitrust or anti-competitive aspects of financial regulation. In the United States, there are a number of specialized fair trading, fair commercial, or antitrust rules that apply to depository institutions in particular. These rules are over and above the general rules of competition that we apply to all areas of our economy. And the question that I'm asking you to think about here is there some special reason to be concerned about anti-competitive practices on the parts of depository institutions? Generally speaking, we think of two distinct types of problems associated with allowing commercial firms to be affiliated with banks, or in this context, for allowing banks to have investments in commercial firms. And let me distinguish the two lines of concern for you right now. First, there is a concern that banks might subsidize their own firms. And let me explain how this might occur. If a bank, such as the bank in the Arnold Tours case, were allowed to invest in a travel agent and to have a controlling interest, and let's just assume that it's a 100% interest in a travel agent, there's a concern that the bank might then use its credit capabilities, its lending capabilities, to subsidize that firm by providing below market loans, which would allow the travel agent to offer its services to the general public at a lower rate than competing travel agencies. So, in this example, to be a little more specific, assume that the competitive lending rate for a bank loan to other borrowers, including other travel agents, was 10%. What would happen if the bank decided that it would lend to its own travel agent at a lower rate of, say, 5%? Is that a concern because it would allow the travel agency to monopolize the travel agency business as a result of its lower costs, eventually driving out competition in the travel agency business and having the bank-affiliated firm dominate the industry? if you think back to the Arnold Tours case, the plaintiffs in that case, the parties that brought the action, were other travel agencies in the area. And obviously, one of their concerns was that they would face unfair competition from the bank-affiliated travel agency, and that, in fact, they might be driven out of business by just such this practice. And one has to concede that in the United States, this sort of concern has led to restrictions on bank expansion into commercial lines. Not only is it risky to the bank, does it affect its safety and soundness potentially, but also such investments threaten to disrupt competition. Now, I should note at this point that this argument, this line of argument, is not necessarily convincing. You need to ask yourself, and this is really a question more of antitrust policy or fair trading policy as opposed to banking regulation, but is it really credible that a bank would subsidize its own travel agency in this way? Would it forego loans at the rate of 10% and make subsidized loans to its affiliate for some sustained period of time in the hopes of monopolizing the travel agency business? The usual answer to this question is that the bank would engage in such practices only if it thought it could recoup its lost revenues by subsequently raising prices charged by the travel agency to the general public, presumably, but also in direct returns to the bank as owner of the travel agent over some future period of time. So the idea would be that the bank might drive the other travel agents out of business in a year or two, and then in subsequent years recoup its losses by charging higher prices to the general public. Now, the question really is it credible to believe that a bank would be able to do this in the travel agency business, or just as soon as the bank-affiliated travel agent raised its prices, wouldn't other travel agents return to the industry and seek to compete again now that the bank was no longer offering subsidized rates? So the question about this practice is it credible? Is it sustainable over the long term? And that, it turns out, depends on the nature of the line of commerce we're talking about. It's plausible in some businesses where there are high barriers to entry, where it's difficult for other firms to return, that a bank or any other monopolist might be able to sustain its position over the long run. But it is not clear that this would be true of every area of business, and it's certainly not necessarily true whether it would be true of the travel agency area of business, which is a relatively simple form of business with relatively low costs of starting operations, and therefore it's generally assumed relatively low barriers to entry. So I leave it to you to think about the credibility of this concern, but let me just say one of the reasons historically that we have restricted banks from entering commercial lines of business is a concern that they might somehow unfairly subsidize affiliated firms. Another potential source of competitive concern relates to the bank's lending practices to other borrowers. And here in particular, one is thinking about other borrowers who engage in the travel agency business. Might it be possible for the bank to deny these competitive firms credit or charge credit at a rate that would put them at a serious disadvantage to the bank-affiliated travel agent? In this illustration, I have suggested that the loans might be priced at 25%, substantially higher than the 10% rate that would be the competitive charge for lending. This, in the United States at least, has been another historic concern about banks entering the travel agency business. It might be possible in certain markets for them to impose such higher lending costs on competitive firms and thereby give their own travel agent a competitive advantage. If so, this would allow the banks to monopolize the travel agency business, or at least gain competitive advantage at the expense of other firms. Again, however, one must ask whether this is a credible competitive risk that would justify restricting the banks making investments in commercial firms. The answer, once again, depends on other economic considerations. In particular, the potential for other sources of credit to be supplied to competitive firms. In particular, imagine that there are other lenders in the market, either banks or other financial institutions that make credit available to borrowers. If there were other lenders available, it's not clear whether a bank could hurt competitors through raising the cost of credit for them, because the competitors could go to other lending firms and obtain competitive loans, presumably priced at 10%. Thus, the degree of risk from this particular factor depends on the nature of the lending markets. Historically in the United States, when our lending markets were highly fragmented and the plausible sources of credit were limited to local banks, there was considerable concern that banks might be able to give affiliated firms competitive advantage through restricting credit to other competitors. More recently, however, in the United States, as the lending markets have become more national, and as other sorts of lenders, such as, for example, household finance, whom we considered in the unidentified financial institutions exercise in Lecture 1, the presence of these other lenders has made it more difficult for banks to interfere with the borrowing practices of competitive firms. So, in certain markets, the capability of banks to deny credit to competitors is limited. However, in other markets, it is a serious concern and is a further justification for denying banks the right to make investments in commercial businesses. I have now said about all that I want to say about the substance of anti-competitive concerns for bank investments in travel agents and other commercial lines of business. For those of you who are interested in learning more about this subject, Section 4 of Chapter 2 in our casebook, which begins on page 86, offers an introduction to what we term bank antitrust analysis. And if you look through this section of the casebook, you'll see that in the United States, at least, there's a specialized system of antitrust rules for the banking industry. Most notably, whenever banks engage in mergers or acquisitions or other change of control transactions, there is a special scrutiny given to the anti-competitive implications of the transactions, and in particular, the effect of the transaction on concentrations in commercial lending markets. So what this analysis emphasizes is concern over the question of banks monopolizing lending markets, which would give them the capacity to raise the cost of credit in their particular markets. And as you'll see in the United States, specialized tools, including special indices of market share, have been developed. In addition, there are special rules governing tying relationships in the banking industry, which some of you may be interested in, as well as a rather elaborate set of doctrines dealing with joint ventures in the financial services industry. Joint ventures are collaborative arrangements among banking firms and other financial intermediaries to perform certain services which require cooperation. The payment services, the payment systems, is one example of collaborative undertakings, as are credit card operations in the United States, which is actually the focus of discussion in this area. These collaborative arrangements are economically necessary. However, they also pose certain competitive concerns for collusion within the industry, and the doctrine in this area has been developed to balance the necessity of cooperation with potential competitive concerns. So those of you who are interested in these topics, I would invite you to take a look at these pages. For our part, the final issue that I would like to consider here is the relationship between unfair practices and solvency regulation, risk regulation. As you will recall, the Arnold Tours case was initially introduced in the second lecture as a vehicle for discussing risk regulation of bank activities restrictions, regulation designed to enhance primarily the solvency and the safety of banking institutions. How does our discussion this morning of unfair practices relate to solvency regulation? Well, it's an interesting relationship, I think, because in certain respects, the anti-competitive activities that we've been discussing this morning do not really undermine bank solvency in many instances. In fact, they probably enhance it. If you consider for a second the possibilities that banks might raise the rates they charge other borrowers from 10% fair market rates to 25% supra-competitive prices, well, that's actually a good thing for banks in that it increases their revenues. Similarly, if banks are affiliated with firms with monopoly profits in the travel agency business, that probably also enhances their economic viability, albeit at expense to the rest of the economy. So some of the activities here we've been discussing, while raising competitive concerns, do not raise solvency concerns, which creates an interesting problem for bank regulators who are primarily concerned with bank solvency. They may actually not be quite as attuned to anti-competitive problems as other government authorities, because bank regulators are primarily concerned with maintaining the solvency of the industry, and certain anti-competitive practices do not undermine that solvency. There are, of course, some things that banks might do in the area of unfair practices which work in the other direction. If one were to think about the underpriced loans, we thought banks might charge their own travel agents, the 5% loans in this illustration. Now, those loans would, in the short term at least, undercut bank profitability. However, the subsidy would be an advantage to the travel agent, and as long as the travel agent were a subsidiary of the bank, that economic value would in some sense be retained by the bank through its investment in the travel agency. So here one needs to distinguish the relationship between the affiliated travel agent and the bank. As long as it's a subsidiary, as it is in this particular illustration, no value is leaving the banking organization and its subsidiaries. However, if the loans were to a holding company affiliate or a firm owned by a shareholder of the bank, this value might actually be lost to the banking institution, at least in the short term. So the analysis in that situation might be slightly different. So the competitive harm to the bank, or the solvency harm to the bank, would be different in that situation, and that might actually be a situation where an unfair practice would actually threaten solvency. But I think one should think of that as something of a special case. Generally speaking, unfair practices will enhance bank solvency, which makes it an interesting area of regulatory balance. The goal of ensuring fair competition actually makes life a little bit more difficult for banking institutions and is in general in tension with our primary concern about solvency regulation. I also mentioned at the end of last class the possibility that there would be other considerations that would lead us to restrict bank investments in commercial lines of business, concerns of political economy. We will deal with illustrations of that later on in the course, but when we do, you will see that once again, these other public concerns that limit the investment possibilities of banking institutions are often somewhat in tension with the primary regulatory goal in this area of solvency regulation. So that concludes what I want to say about bank antitrust policy and its relationship to activities restrictions. Now let's turn to the primary subject of today's lecture, which is capital regulation. So capital regulation. Capital regulation is, in the United States, perhaps the most important area of depository institution regulation. We have already discussed one area of depository institution regulation, which are activities restrictions. If you look through the casebook, you will see after activities restrictions, we discuss lending limits in sections 4 and 5 of Chapter 3. I plan to return to these in the next class, but what you should understand conceptually is what we are doing in the casebook is working our way around the balance sheet, discussing first the ways in which our bank regulatory structure polices the assets of banking institutions, then in Chapter 3, Section 6, we discuss the regulation of the principal bank liabilities, which are deposits, looking at the kinds of deposits banks are permitted to offer their depositors, and also introducing the concept of deposit insurance. Then, in the next section of the casebook, we take a look at capital regulation, which is the regulation of the amount of shareholders' equity or retained earnings or however is denominated, a buffer amount of funds that are provided not by public depositors but by the owners or the institution itself as a reserve against losses on loans or other claims on the institution's financial resources. As you will recall from the exercise on alternative strategies we discussed last class, capital is a critical component of bank regulation, and the higher the level of capital, the greater the protection of afforded depositors and also the economy generally from losses that banks or depository institutions may suffer. So in constraining the risks associated with the financial services industry, capital regulation is absolutely critical. And therefore, I'd like to dedicate the balance of this hour's class to a discussion of capital regulation in the United States and how it has evolved over time. Now, let's turn to our substantive discussion of capital regulation. As I mentioned earlier, we will be discussing enforcement of capital requirements in the context of the Cushata case, as well as taking a look at the application of modern capital requirements to depository institutions, and then the particular problems associated with moving from lower capital requirements to higher capital requirements as we have in the United States over the past 15 years. Finally, I'll be saying a few words about our current system of capital-based regulation in the United States that has been established since 1991, and in particular, the so-called prompt corrective action rules that were developed under statutory authority enacted in 1991. But before getting into these materials, let me say a few words about the historical background of capital regulation in the United States. Capital requirements have been part of our banking regulatory system since at least the 19th century. Early capital standards, however, were relatively primitive and inadequate in many respects. Initially, capital standards tended to set the minimum amount of capital each institution had to have in order to begin business. So $5,000 or $50,000 or $500,000 of capital would be required as part of the initial chartering process. The problem with these minimum capital standards, expressed in absolute amounts, was that they did not reflect the growth of institutions over time and had no bearing to the relative size of institutions or the peculiar risk characteristics the institutions might undertake. Over time, through a series of ad hoc supervisory actions, leverage requirements were developed in the industry. A leverage requirement is a requirement that demands that capital be a certain percentage of either an institution's assets or its liabilities, so that an institution with $100 million worth of assets would be required to have more capital than an institution with only $15 million of assets. These early capital requirements were ad hoc in the sense that there was no fixed standard that each institution had to maintain, and supervisors had considerable latitude in determining the capital requirements imposed on particular institutions. They were, however, more reflective of the actual risks to which individual institutions were exposed than the earlier absolute capital requirements I just discussed. Throughout most of the middle part of this century, there was a decline in the capital reserves of most depository institutions in the United States, particularly during the period from the 1930s through the 1970s. There was a number of reasons for this decline. First of all, after the crisis of the Great Depression in the early 1930s, the banking industry stabilized and was relatively stable for most of the 1940s and 50s and into the 1960s. So with the perceived decline in risk to which depository institutions were exposed, banks felt comfortable in reducing the amount of their capital reserves and, incidentally, increasing the return to their equity owners by increasing their leverage. Another development during the 1930s and into the latter part of the century was the increase in federal deposit insurance for most depository institutions. Federal deposit insurance was first established in the 1930s, but grew in significance and coverage throughout the century until the 1980s. What this meant is that depositors were less concerned about the solvency of their banking institutions because much of their deposits were insured by the federal government. Hence, there was less incentive for them to insist on higher capital reserves for the banks with which they did business. For a combination of these and other reasons, the capital reserves of banks declined until the early 1980s. At that point, however, it became clear that the stability that the banking industry had enjoyed in the preceding decades was not to last. Higher rates of interest, shocks to the economy from the oil crises of the 1970s, and other economic disruptions created instability in the banking industry and other sectors of the U.S. economy, and bank failures once again became relatively common in the United States. At this time, there was a perception that more consistency in capital requirements was needed, and certain judicial decisions of the period cast some doubt on the authority of banking authorities to develop consistent systems of capital regulation. So, in 1983, with the International Lending Supervision Act passed that year, an act designed primarily to deal with the third world debt crisis, Congress strengthened the authority of bank regulators to impose capital requirements. And based on this authority, the banking agencies developed consistent rules of leverage for the banking industry. In general, banks at this time were required to have 6% total capital, that is, total capital equal to 6% of assets, and primary capital, or sometimes referred now as core capital, equal to 5.5% of assets. This is the capital regime that was in place when the Cruchada case took place, and I will discuss that shortly. But let me just note at this time that the structure of capital regulation in the United States continued to evolve in the 1980s. In particular, in 1989, the country began to move towards a risk-based capital requirement, where capital requirements would be not based simply on single leverage requirements, such as those imposed in 1983, but a more complex formula of capital measurements known as risk-based capital. We will also discuss those requirements later in this lecture. Finally, later in the century, in 1991, Congress made major changes in the overall regulatory structure of depository institutions with the imposition of so-called prompt corrective action rules, which are directly related to the capital requirements established a few years earlier. The Cruchada case, which appears on page 188 of our casebook, is, I think, a good introduction to capital regulation in the United States. Since this is one of the first enforcement cases we've looked at in this lecture series, let me also use this case as an illustration to discuss a little bit about the background of banking regulation within our larger legal system in the United States. The Bank of Cruchada case involves a state chartered bank, that is, a bank chartered under the laws of the state of Louisiana. It has FDIC insurance, so it is a federally insured state chartered bank, and its primary federal regulator is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So it's not a national bank, therefore not regulated by the Comptroller of the Currency. It's also not a member of the Federal Reserve System, which would make its primary federal regulator the Federal Reserve Board. It is what's known as an FDIC-insured non-member bank. So the federal governmental authority in charge of this institution is the FDIC. At the time the case comes along, the capital requirements are the 1983 version of capital requirements, which are 6% of total assets is a capital rule, and primary capital or core capital has to be 5.5% of assets. So that's the capital standard that's imposed on banks in the United States, whatever the regulatory authority. And because this is an FDIC-insured bank, it is supervised by the FDIC, which is the agency bringing the enforcement action here. Now, the case does not fully describe what has preceded this litigation, but you can tell if you read carefully that the problem the bank has suffered has to do with losses on its lending portfolio. So there's a problem that's developed in the bank's assets. There's no reason that you should know this, but during this period in the 1980s, the state of Louisiana had an economic downturn. A lot of activities were related to oil exploration in the state, which suffered losses during this period. And apparently, as a result, a number of the borrowers to whom the bank had lent money were unable to repay their loans according to their terms. Presumably, the weakness in the lending portfolio was discovered in the course of routine examinations by either the bank's auditors or the FDIC, perhaps also state examiners. But in any event, extra loan losses were discovered that were unexpected, the bank was required to write down the value of those assets, which would have reduced the bank's earnings, probably imposed a loss on its earnings for the years 1998 and 1999. And what this did was to reduce capital because, as in the strategies exercise we discussed, when a bank suffers losses, its capital is reduced. And this bank's capital was reduced beneath 5% of assets, which is well below the level required to be in compliance with capital standards at in effect at the time of this case. So this is not an uncommon situation for a bank in a troubled economy. Its capital falls beneath the required level. And then the question is, what will happen? If you read through the case, what happened is the FDIC issued a capital directive, which is a regulatory order requiring the bank, its board of directors, perhaps also its owners, to infuse additional capital into the bank to bring it into compliance with applicable regulations. Now, the legal issue in this case has to do with the issuance of this capital directive. And in particular, the question is, to what extent would the judiciary, would the courts, review the decision of the agency to issue this directive? So this is an interesting legal case in certain respects. It has to do with the relationship between the judicial system and the bank regulatory authorities. And as you can tell, as you read through the case, there is a general presumption in the United States that governmental actions taken by agencies will be subject to judicial review. It does not necessarily mean that the action will be overturned or the courts will impose their judgment in lieu of the judgment of the regulatory agencies, but it does mean that the agency's actions will be subject to review to ensure that they are in compliance with applicable legal standards. Now, that's the background assumption here, and the particular question this case raises is whether the agency action to issue the directive itself is subject to judicial review or not. The FDIC's position is that judicial review is not appropriate at this time. The bank argues that it should be subject to judicial review. Let's look now at the statutory provisions at issue in this case. You can find copies of these in the statutory supplement under 12 U.S.C. section 3907, which is a statutory authority granted to the federal banking agencies in 1993 to establish capital standards for the banking industry. In particular, the provision on the slide shown now grants the appropriate federal banking agencies, which in the case of the Bank of Quechada is the FDIC, the authority to establish minimum capital levels for banking institutions using such methods as the banking agencies deem appropriate. Now, in this case, it's a 6% capital requirement that they've deemed appropriate. Subsection 2 here goes on to allow banking agencies to establish higher capital requirements for particular institutions if they presumably are engaged in more risky activities. But at issue in this case is just the general capital requirements of 6%. In addition to giving the banking agencies the authority to establish capital requirements, they also have the authority to issue directives to institutions to maintain capital at appropriate levels. And that's really what's at issue here. The authority shown in this provision is to issue a directive that calls on individual institutions to adhere to a plan to raise capital. And more importantly, the directive is given the authority of law in the sense that it can be enforced with respect to the institutions and other parties bound by the directive. Now, what all this means is if the FDIC issues a capital directive with respect to the Bank of Quechada and the bank or its board of directors fails to comply with that directive, then they can be subject to a variety of enforcement sanctions, civil money penalties, potentially, or also contempt orders from the judiciary. So the directive, once issued, takes on the force of law and can have legal consequences to the banking institution and the parties in question. There are a variety of other supervisory actions that the banking agencies could also bring if a bank has inadequate capital, including ultimately closing the institution down. But this capital directive provides a separate regulatory device with separate enforcement possibilities. What the defendant in this case, or what the banking institution in this case is charging, is the directive should not be allowed to issue without judicial review. In particular, what the bank is arguing in this case is that our General Administrative Procedure Act, which governs all U.S. governmental actions, presumptively, has a judicial review requirement which should be applied in this case. And if you read through the decision, you'll see that, in fact, under the so-called APA, judicial review is presumed unless another statute expressly precludes review or if the statute leaves the matter to the agency's discretion. And what the court holds in this case is the statute, that is the International Lending Supervision Act of 1983, does in fact leave to the agency the discretion to issue capital directives. And if you look back to the slides that I previously had on the screen, you will see that discretion does seem to be granted to the agency to issue these sorts of directives, provided certain procedures are followed, including the opportunity for the parties to issue responses within certain periods of time and various other procedural safeguards. So the court's holding on this issue is that the APA does not provide additional sources of judicial review given the structure of the Banking Act. Now, interestingly, I think from this perspective of comparative regulatory analysis, the court's decision does not end with the Administrative Procedure Act, the general statutory structure for protection of individual rights against governmental action. Rather, the analysis in the case has a second step. And this second step is a constitutional analysis. The federal constitution guarantees individuals and also commercial enterprises certain protections from arbitrary and capricious governmental action. And in particular, it affords banking institutions the right to procedural due process, to certain procedures before governmental actions are taken. And if you read through this part of the case, what you will see is the court then analyzes the bank regulatory structure to a constitutional analysis, which entails, under the doctrine that the Supreme Court has developed, a balancing of interests, the interests of the bank regulators, ensuring the safety and soundness of the banking system, the interests of the parties to whom a directive may be issued, from arbitrary, capricious denial of rights or loss of important property interests. Here, what the court concludes is that there are procedural safeguards built into the capital directive provisions, and also, I think most importantly, before the actions of the judiciary can be brought to bear in a contempt proceeding or an enforcement action under 1818B, which is the cease and desist authority that I alluded to earlier, there would be subsequent judicial review. So, although judicial review was not guaranteed at this point in the process, there would later be an opportunity for the courts to get involved to make sure that the governmental action was not capricious and generally in compliance with the statutory structure developed by Congress. So, the court concludes here that the constitutional requirements are met by this statutory structure, and therefore the capital directive can issue. So in this case, the directive was allowed to issue as written by the FDIC before enforcement of the directive could be had through a cease and desist proceeding. There would be the opportunity for judicial intervention, and that was enough to satisfy the court. So what I would like you to take away from this case is an understanding that the capital standards, at least the setting of the capital standards in the United States, is largely left to the discretion of the banking agencies to develop what they consider to be appropriate capital standards and to issue the particular kind of regulatory enforcement tool discussed here, which is the capital directive, without intervention of the courts. There are, however, important procedural protections built into this structure, guaranteeing some protection to the banking institutions, and the judiciary is in the background requiring the agencies to generally comply with the statutory structure that Congress has developed. We'll see later on in the course when we look at other enforcement provisions the important role that the courts do play in this area in the United States, and I will reserve until that point in the lecture series further discussion of these safeguards. Let's turn now to the actual calculation of capital requirements, and in particular the problems 3.20 and 3-21 from the casebook. Looking at my watch at this point, I see that we are well through the hour for Lecture 4, and that it will not be possible for me to complete our discussion of capital requirements today. And so what I propose to do is in Lecture 5 to continue our discussion of capital and the prompt corrective action provisions, and to put off discussion of lending limits and affiliated party rules until the following class. So I will explain at the end of this hour the precise assignments for next week. But let me just note at this point that we will not be completing our discussion of capital today. The first exercise that I want to look at is exercise 3-20. But before doing that, let me just review the structure of modern capital requirements in the United States. These materials are covered on page 184 to 186 of the casebook, and you should read over those pages to get a fuller sense of the regulatory structure. But what these pages explain is how the American system of bank capital regulation got more sophisticated in the 1980s, moving from the simple capital requirements that were at issue in the Bank of Quechua case to more complex current capital requirements. In certain respects, the modern capital requirements build on the traditional leverage rules that you saw in the Quechua case. We have basically a two-tier capital requirement, a simple leverage requirement for core capital, which is sometimes called Tier 1 capital now, that must be 3 to 5% of total assets, depending on the regulatory status of the institution involved. Well-managed institutions, the vast majority of institutions, have to have core capital of 3% of total assets, whereas those with supervisory problems and lower ratings under the CAMEL system, which is described in this section of the casebook, they may have to have up to 5% core capital as a percentage of total assets. What's really remarkable about the new capital requirements, however, is the risk-based capital requirement. There is a calculation, which we will work through in the next few slides, of risk adjustment to the assets of depository institutions to generate what's known as risk-weighted assets. And with this risk-adjusted measure, banks must have 4% core capital, or Tier 1 capital, and then 8% total capital, or core capital, plus Tier 2 capital. So there are, in essence, three separate capital requirements that are applied. the core capital and the total capital requirements under the risk-based system, and then also the simple leverage requirements described above. I think the best way to understand these rules is to take a look at a particular illustration of them, and what I'd like to begin with is problem 320. So let's begin by taking a look at problem 320 on page 197. If you look at the problem, it describes an institution with $1.4 billion of assets divided between government securities, mortgages, and consumer and business loans. Using the structure that we discussed in the first class in the unidentified financial institution, the balance sheet looks similar to what is shown on the screen. Now, the first question to ask is, does the institution meet its basic leverage requirement, which is that core capital or Tier 1 capital be greater than 3 to 5%? Well, to answer that question, we must first consider what is this core capital. That's something that you can find in the statutory supplement that you all have by now. Now, if you look back at the regulatory section for bank regulations, you will find materials on bank capital requirements, and you will see as you look through the supplement that they're quite extensive. One of the critical elements of the statutory supplement materials is the definitions of Tier 1 capital or core capital. And you will see what's listed here are several kinds of capital that's considered to be high-quality capital, and the most important category is common stockholders' equity. This would be the investment of common shareholders into the corporation that cannot easily be withdrawn in times of trouble, that has no particular dividend rights, and that is available to absorb economic shocks that the institution suffers. So, if you look back at the institution's balance sheet, you will see that it does have a substantial amount of this sort of Tier 1 capital, and in particular, $65 million worth. Returning now to problem 320, we're in a position to answer the question of whether the bank meets its capital leverage requirements. $65 million is roughly 4.64% of $1.4 billion. Now, is that enough to meet the core leverage requirements? Well, the answer is you can't really tell without knowing the regulatory status of the particular institution. But in all likelihood, its core capital requirement would be 3 to 4% of total assets, and this amount, 4.64%, would be comfortably in excess of the minimum requirement. So, in all likelihood, this institution does meet its core capital requirements. What about its risk-based capital requirements? Well, to make that decision, you need to do a little more work. What you need to do is make an adjustment of the assets for the risk weightings that the capital requirements impose. Now, this institution has a relatively simple balance sheet with only three different types of assets: government securities, which have a zero risk weighting, mortgages, that is, loans secured by residential real estate, typically, which have a 50% weighting, and then consumer and business loans, which typically have a 100% weighting. If you factor in these weightings, what you see is that the institution has only $1 billion of risk-weighted assets, or less than its total assets of $1.4 billion. That means that it has a Tier 1 capital requirement on a risk-adjusted basis of $40 million. And as its Tier 1 capital is $65 million, or 6.5% of risk-weighted asset, it comfortably meets that requirement. So the institution so far has met two out of three of its capital requirements. The final requirement that it has to meet is the requirement of total capital as a percentage of risk-weighted assets. Does it meet that requirement? Well, a quick look at the balance sheet might suggest the answer is yes, because it has $65 million of common equity plus a $15 million loss reserve. But if you look more carefully at the regulatory requirements here, you'll see an interesting factor. Back in the definition of Tier 2 capital, there are a list of the kinds of equity investments and other items that count towards Tier 2 capital. Looking at the bottom of this list for a second, you can see items like cumulative perpetual preferred stock, hybrid capital instruments, subordinate debt instruments, all count more or less in their entirety to Tier 2 capital. These are all investments in a company that will provide some cushion against losses, but are not, in for a variety of reasons, considered to be as permanent and as valuable for capital compliance purposes as common equity. So all of these items, preferred stock, hybrid instruments, subordinate debt, might count towards Tier 2 capital, but the institution we're looking at here doesn't have these items. What it has is $15 million of loan loss reserves. Now, the loan loss reserves are an interesting accounting entry. These are general reserves for loan losses that institutions in the United States, at least, maintain on their balance sheet. In a sense, they are there to absorb losses suffered on from assets, and they are not associated with specific problem loans. So they are general loss reserves rather than specific loss reserves. And under the rules that have been developed in the United States and around the world, these loan loss reserves are allowed to count towards Tier 2 capital, but only up to a certain amount, and that amount is 1.25% of risk-weighted assets. So there is a cap on the percentage of loan loss reserves that can count towards risk-based capital. And actually, this institution has 1.5% of their risk-weighted assets in loan loss reserves. So applying this restriction, not all of the loan loss reserves can count towards Tier 2 capital. And if you make this adjustment, what you see in this case is only $12.5 million of the loan loss reserves can be counted in Tier 2 capital. And when that's added to the $65 million of core capital, the institution has total capital equal to only 7.75% of its risk-weighted assets, and it therefore fails the third capital requirement. It fails the total capital as a percentage of risk-weighted assets requirement. So here is, I think, an interesting application of the risk-based capital rules. This institution met its capital requirements under the leverage test. And in fact, it would have met its capital requirements under the old pre-1989 6% test quite comfortably. However, the risk-weighted asset test developed in 1989 in the United States is more stringent. It has a higher capital requirement of 8% of risk-weighted capital, and it is more limited in the extent to which it allows institutions to rely on loan loss reserves. So, as a result of this strengthening of capital requirements in the late 1980s and early 1990s, this particular hypothetical institution would have fallen into non-compliance with capital requirements. So, in the late 1980s, what happened in the United States and what you're seeing in here is a general strengthening of the capital requirements and also a recognition that the old leverage rules were not adequately sensitive to the kind of assets that particular institutions held. In this particular case, the institution had a relatively small amount of its assets, 20%, in government securities, and the majority of its assets in consumer and business loans, which face some degree of economic risk, as well as a fair amount of mortgages, which also face economic risk. One way this institution could have brought itself into compliance, and what a number of the institutions in the United States did in the late 1980s and early 1990s, is comply with their capital rules by changing the mix of their assets. They moved assets out of consumer and business loans and into government securities and perhaps to a lesser extent mortgages. So without raising any new capital, they change their capital requirements by changing the structure of their balance sheet. Now, presumably that was the effect that was desired by government regulators, because increasing the amount of government securities, a relatively low-risk investment, actually improved the risk characteristics of the institution, and therefore made the amount of capital the institution held more adequate with respect to the institution's revised portfolio. That, at least, is the theory of risk-based capital requirements. I see now that our time is almost up, and so rather than going on with the capital requirement exercises, what I would like to leave you with is this stylized balance sheet of problem 321, which I have put together based on the balance sheet that is mentioned in the problem that appears earlier in the casebook, and leave it to you to try your hand at figuring out whether this institution meets the capital requirements. To do that, you will need to make certain assumptions about the kinds of assets on the balance sheet of the institution. I think one item that is not obvious, the large billion-dollar item cash and due from banks, that's probably mostly items in the collection process that would have a 20% risk weighting. The federal funds are collateralized items, probably also would have a 20% risk weighting. Others you can probably try to figure out based on the readings. The point is not to get the calculations entirely correct. That's actually sort of a technical matter that takes a good deal of practice, but just to see how they operate. So for next week, if you would take your hand at this particular problem, I think that would be a good idea. Yeah. In addition, if you haven't had a chance to do it already, I would suggest you take a look at the Windstar case, which is an interesting and important case in the United States, may have some interest to the Chinese situation, to the extent that bank failures are on the horizon for some institutions in China. And then at this point, I think I would like to ask you, since we're going to spend a little more time on the capital exercises and capital requirements in general, to take a look at the materials on prompt corrective action, which appear on page 361 and 362 of the casebook. You might also be interested in taking a look at the statutory supplement at 12 U.S.C. section 1831-0, which are the prompt corrective action rules, just to get a sense of how they work. You may find them a bit complicated, but I will talk about them in next week's class. So at this point, I'd like to conclude the fourth lecture in this series. We will continue our discussion of capital requirements in Lecture 5. I actually think, since in many respects capital requirements are the most important feature of depository institution regulation nowadays, at least in the United States, that a fairly extensive discussion of capital requirements is in order. And I hope you will enjoy our continued discussion of the topic next week. So I'd like to sign off now, and I look forward to meeting with you again next week.